Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, the amazingly popular new version of Upstairs Downstairs is, as it turns out, an only slightly updated take on the amazingly popular BBC original series from the 1970s. A look at how publishers and librarians alike are dreaming up new business models for e-books. And NPR movie critic Bob Mondello considers another British remake and original, Arthur, one of Hollywood's few rich, lovable drunks. But first,
the latest Spanish-language soap opera sensation, La Reina del Sur, is hitting the airwaves on Telemundo. In its debut week last month, it ranked first in the 10 o'clock time slot across all U.S. broadcast networks. It's the first Spanish soap to feature a female drug lord, and as Genesis Sanchez reports, it's the latest in a fast-growing genre, telenovelas about Mexico's explosive drug war.
I'm usually not a big fan of sitting down and watching TV when I get home, but the 10 o'clock hour became my sacred TV time. Once my friends told me about Muñecas de la Mafia, or Mafia Dolls. It's about five young women getting involved with the drug dealers known as narcos in Colombia and Mexico. That's a drug lord grabbing one of his main girls by the hair and accusing her of being a snitch. These soap operas aren't too far from the reality of the drug war in Mexico these days, with all the same dramatic ingredients: executions, lavish lifestyles, and international fame. They're part of what I call narcocultura. Radio DJ Sergio Garcia just moved to the U.S. from Tijuana about a year ago and says many young people there idolize the drug dealers.
Yo quiero ser narco.
It's almost as if saying, I want to be a narco is in style, as is having a brand new car, having rhinestones on your clothes, going to nightclubs, having a lot of women, having a lot of money, and just being able to spend however much you want. It's mainly just about being able to feel that power.
Narcocultura broke into pop culture about 5 years ago with a type of music called narcocorridos, Mexican drug ballads. Mafia nueva, sinaloense, pura plebada de arranque. The lyrics are all about who the drug lords will kill next, their guns made out of gold and decorated with diamonds, and how many women they have. Narcocorrido fans are usually men trying to get their macho fix. The narconovelas on TV, on the other hand, target women.
No anda con un man cualquiera, no. Tiene que ser el man más embilletado con las que pintas.
Muñecas de la Mafia is nothing like the typical soap operas. Stories of a poor girl in love with a rich guy whose evil grandma hates on their romance. In Mafia Dolls, the struggles are all about surviving in the drug game. The show debuted on the Univision Network last year around the same time that big-name narco families were getting busted in Mexico. Producer Dago Garcia is the vice president of production at Caracol TV in Colombia, where most of the narco novelas are produced. Garcia says a decade ago, Colombian producers would have been too scared to portray narcos.
The narco theme had been suppressed for different reasons, mainly because it was a topic that couldn't be discussed without having your life at risk.
Now that Colombia's government claims to have won the battle with drug dealers, Colombian producers are safe to make shows about drug culture. And these novelas are being distributed all over Latin America and the U.S., influencing how Latinos in other countries view the drug war. My friend Carmen Ramirez is surprised to find herself sympathizing with the narcos on Muñecas de la Mafia.
For example, you'll see me commenting on the novela and I'll just be like, oh, I feel bad for him because his daughter gets kidnapped. But then again, I don't feel bad when they shoot an innocent person.
Lupe Gallegos-Diaz, who works with Chicano students at UC Berkeley, thinks that narconovelas glamorize the drug world.
Most of the time, it's about a sexual objectification of women and what I considered not very healthy, sometimes, messages for our young women, particularly short skirts, you know, low cleavage, high heels.
There is more complexity being written into future narco soaps. Novela producer Dago Garcia says he's going to add another layer to the stories.
The next dimension of what we're going to talk about in this subject is the dimension of the victims. Because up until now, all these productions have been taking a look into the reality of narcos and their relationships.
It seems like everyone I talk to about narcocultura is also passionately following news of the drug war in Mexico. But with these new narconovelas, it's easy to lose sight of the line between the real-life war and the entertainment inspired by it. For NPR News, I'm Genesis Sanchez.
Genesis Sanchez is a reporter for Turnstile, that's an online news service from Youth Radio. A lot of attention has been paid to the way bookstores and publishing companies are managing the e-book revolution, but far less has been paid to the role of libraries. When HarperCollins recently announced that it would limit the number of times its e-books can be borrowed, it sparked a larger conversation about the future of libraries in the digital age. NPR's Lynn Neary has the story.
You don't have to go anywhere near a library to check out an e-book. You can download it onto your digital device in a matter of seconds. And there's no more pesky overdue notices. The e-book simply disappears from your device when your time is up.
The fact is that with a digital item, if you give it to somebody, you still have it. It doesn't have to come back.
Eli Nyberger is the director for IT and production at the Ann Arbor District Library in Michigan. E-books, says Nyberger, are really digital files, but libraries and publishers are still trying to deal with them as if they're just like print books, and they're trying to do business the way they have always done business.
Part of the models that we've seen so far are still trying to force 20th century business models onto digital content, and any digital native says, what, you mean I have to wait to download an e-book? What sense does that make? And they're off to the Kindle store to spend, what, you know, $3.99 or $4.99 or $9.99 to get that same book.
In the current climate, libraries worry they'll become obsolete. Publishers are afraid they won't be able to make any money. That's why HarperCollins came up with a new e-book policy, which says its e-books can only be checked out 26 times before they have to be repurchased. Leslie Hulse, a senior vice president at HarperCollins, says publishers have to place some limitations on the way libraries loan e-books.
So I think the tension is, at the extreme, we could be making a book available to one national library on a simultaneous access model in perpetuity. And what that would mean is that everyone in the country could check out that book for free at any time, and that's not a sort of a commercially viable solution.
HarperCollins may have raised the ire of librarians around the country with their new e-book policy, but Christopher Platt, director of collections and circulation at the New York Public Library, says the move has also stimulated a lot more public discussion about the future of libraries and e-books.
The HarperCollins limit of 26 checkouts per item isn't going to stick. It's going to develop into something new. And Harper, to their credit, is very engaged with libraries and reaching out to them now to see really what would work.
Platt has his own ideas about what might work for the future. He says libraries use intermediaries to manage both their physical and digital book collections. He thinks libraries could work with these intermediaries to develop subscription packages of e-books. Libraries would pay the publishers for these subscriptions and use them as they see fit.
So I buy a title with 1,000 uses, right? And then it's up to us and our readers, the library readers, whether those 1,000 uses get used simultaneously in the first few days or whether they're drawn out over time. And then if they do get used very quickly, we'll buy more.
Eli Nyberger has a more radical idea. He thinks libraries could deal directly with content providers.
The goal of the library is to obtain the ability to distribute content to its public. And if we can do that easier and more cheaply with the rights holder or the artist themselves, and they make more money on it, you know, it may be heretical, but you know, the future usually is.
That idea has potential, says Christopher Platt, but it may not be practical in the long run.
In some scenarios, that will happen, and that will grow. You will see more original content coming into library collections going forward. And I think that's a wonderful thing, especially if libraries play a role in the creation of that content. But on a regular matter of just ordering at scale the number of e-books that we add to our collection, that's a very difficult thing to manage.
From the traditional to the visionary, the conversation about libraries in the digital age has begun in earnest. Roberta Stevens, president of the American Library Association, wants more publishing companies to get involved in the conversation because at the moment, some publishers aren't even willing to sell e-books to libraries. Libraries may be able to survive without those books now, says Stevens, but in the future, a lot of books will only be available electronically.
When we look at the future, then we have to really think very seriously about what is our role and how can we actually serve the millions and millions of people who use our public libraries every day if we can't even get access to titles.
Libraries have always been thought of as a kind of temple of books, a place you can go to for peace and quiet, a place to read and think They're an intricate part of the fabric that pulls a community together. But if they are to be relevant in the future, they'll have to make space for themselves in the digital community as well. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
It's been 30 years since British comedian Dudley Moore played a charming drunk in the hit comedy Arthur. And it's been 31 years since the founding of the organization called MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. With the remake of Arthur opening today, Bob Mondello has been thinking about how changes in social attitudes about alcohol can also change what we find funny.
The notion of a lovable drunk was always problematic, at least to people who have come into contact with actual drunks. But the way Dudley Moore played the original Arthur, the character seemed aware that he was a mess from the very first scene.
I am Arthur.
Yeah, what are you drinking?
Scotch. Would you like some?
Why not?
You with me and you can ask that question.
A sad sack, but jokey, drunk. Where'd we seen that before? Well, Shakespeare's Falstaff, for starters, and the tipsy disciples of Dionysus in Greek comedy, and, of course, in vaudeville. One American vaudevillian, W.C. Fields, leapt from stage to screen right in the middle of Prohibition, tippling all the way.
These clothes are pretty dry, so sprinkle them with alcohol.
If tragedy shows us at our best, falling, but from a great height, comedy tends to show us at our worst, staggering and reeling stupidly in the gutter. Alcohol is an effective tool for putting someone in that condition, so many comics play drunk scenes, but few are willing to stay in the gutter with alcohol. Chaplin's Little Tramp would never have been popular had he been the Little Lush. When TV came along, excessive drinkers were relegated to the sidelines, where they fell into categories. The 50s bar hound on the Jackie Gleason show.
Hi, Joe. Hello, Mr. Dane.
The 60s town drunk on the Andy Griffith show.
Otis, I don't reckon you've noticed, but you got a horse that gives milk.
I knew he was a good boy.
The 70s sophisticated lush on the Dean Martin show.
Well, I still have a feeling I've seen your face.
Please.
Someplace else. No, it's always been right here.
But even Dino didn't lean too heavily on the tipsy stuff. It takes special material and a special kind of actor to make long-haul inebriation play as something other than self-destructive. The one guy who indisputably managed it is Jimmy Stewart as Elwood P. Dowd, a barroom regular whose best friend is a 6-foot-tall, invisible rabbit named Harvey.
Well, Harvey and I sit on the bars, and we bantered as strangers. Soon we have friends. And they come over and they tell about the big, terrible things they've done and the big, wonderful things they'll do. All very large, because nobody ever brings anything small into a bar.
This, you'll note, is gentle and sweet, non-threatening tipsiness. Hollywood left the problem side of problem drinking to serious pictures, Lost Weekend, Days of Wine and Roses, while comic characters rarely suffered much more than a hangover, until the 1970s.
They're gonna nail us no matter what we do. So we might as well have a good time.
Toga!
Animal House reveled in the destructive side of drinking, the humors in the mess being made by loud, reckless alcoholics in training. It was a seismic shift, widely imitated, coming just 3 years before the first Arthur movie, and it likely accounts for something very deliberate about how Arthur's title character was conceived. The screenplay has Dudley Moore drinking not just from bars, but also from a well of self-pity. Since he knows he's pathetic, the audience is off the hook, not required to judge him more harshly than he's judging himself. That said, there are scenes in the first Arthur that would be inconceivable today. Arthur drinking and driving, for instance. Today, a whole generation has grown up hearing, "Friends don't let friends drive drunk." There's no drunk driving in the new Arthur. In fact, if you were just going by the trailer, you'd swear there was no drinking at all. Russell Brand is shown acting childish, not drunk. He's an overgrown kid.
How does this bag of tea work?
Be careful, it's going to be very, very...
Oh, God, no!
Hot.
Why hide Arthur's drinking now? Because these days, while tipsiness can still make us laugh, an alcoholic is just sad. Which doesn't mean filmmakers won't find other ways of making characters reel around stupidly. For proof, you need look no further than the title of another film opening today, a medieval stoner comedy called Your Highness. I'm Bob Mondello.
Upstairs, Downstairs is back with a three-part sequel. It was one of the most popular British television series of all time, a leisurely look back at Britain when class distinctions were firmly embedded in the culture, when everybody knew his or her place. Upstairs were the titled and wealthy Bellamys. Downstairs were the working-class heroes who cooked and swept and made the upstairs people's lives as smooth and elegant as possible. NPR's Linda Wertheimer never missed an episode. Here's her report on Upstairs, Downstairs, the sequel.
The sequel was created to celebrate the show's 40th anniversary. The cast is almost entirely new, except for Jean Marsh, who played a central role in the original Rose, the Upstairs Maid. Here's a moment from the earliest days. Rose is instructing a new servant, played by Pauline Collins, about her duties.
I trust you can remember your duties.
And we're to make sure that Emily's got the range working properly. Then lay up breakfast in the servants' hall.
And don't forget to shine up the milk jug, for goodness sake, and don't leave sticky finger marks.
Jean Marsh created the original Upstairs Downstairs with her old friend, actress Eileen Atkins, who also appears in the sequel. Both women came from working-class backgrounds. Both had parents who were servants. They got the idea watching a period drama on television.
We'd been watching something full of rich people, rich food, beautiful clothes, and we had chips on our shoulders, I suppose, and we thought, who did all this work? Who cooked? Who washed up, etc.? And all those things we put together and thought, let's write something about the downstairs people, the servants, the people who serve.
When I suggested to Jean Marsh that her American audience found the downstairs crew more interesting than the fancy people upstairs, she primly observed that in the original, more airtime is spent upstairs. Now the Bellamys are gone, but their wonderful house, 165 Eaton Place, remains, and Rose is now running an employment bureau for servants. She's hired by the new family to find a staff for Eaton Place. In this scene, she's trying to hire a cook.
You want this new position, or don't you?
I prefer a basement kitchen.
This one has a basement kitchen.
How do you know?
It's an Eaton Place. Number 165.
The Bellamy House?
Yes.
You ought to ask if they take you on. Upstairs maid again.
Mrs. Thackeray, you can't turn back the clock. 40 years I was in service to that family.
Jean Marsh wrote a backstory for her character Rose to account for the years between the two versions of Upstairs Downstairs and took it to the new writer, Heidi Thomas.
Heidi and I talked about Rose's past. It had to be adjusted a bit. And it was Heidi's idea that I wouldn't step too far from what I had done. And it was just enough, a step up the ladder, and I think it was believable.
In fact, it was Heidi Thomas who wanted Rose as a bridge between the two series. Thomas decided to set the new version in 1936.
When I started my historical research, it just became obvious that we should pick up the threads in January of 1936, because that was the beginning of a remarkable year in British history. It's known as the Year of Three Kings. King George V died in January. His son, Edward VIII, ascended the throne immediately. And by December the 11th of 1936, he had abdicated because of his love for Mrs. Wallis Simpson, and George VI had ascended the throne. And I just loved the idea that we could have one year in 165 Eaton Place covering the reigns of three kings.
Wallis Simpson makes a brief appearance at Eaton Place, behaving badly. Contemporary politics and the looming possibility of world war figure in the plot. Eileen Atkins plays the eccentric mother of Sir Hallam Holland, who's in the Foreign Office. She has a pet monkey and very strong opinions. Here's a scene where the upstairs family is gathered after dinner, and the Atkins character is lecturing her son's young sister-in-law about her heedless admiration for Sir Oswald Mosley, a leader of the British fascists.
Why on earth are you giving her Mosley to read?
Because at the Londonderry ball, when he was pointed out, all she could say was, "What a handsome man."
Oh, Percy, that's just vulgar.
True, though. I could get quite keen on politics.
People like us don't get keen on politics. We take an interest. We have an informed view. Governments alter. We remain constant. But you must read the works of all the party leaders.
Percy's really rather busy at the moment.
Percy needs exposure to the issues of the day. After all, she spent her early years in Wales.
I wouldn't want to leave you with the impression that this is purely a history lesson. There are lovely rooms to look at least one tiara, and some of the most beautiful maternity dresses you'll ever see. But the link to history makes it all work, according to Jean Marsh and Heidi Thomas.
For these characters, 1936 is the present. We know what's going to happen in 1939. They don't. They don't know necessarily that Hitler is a bad man. That is going to become apparent in their near future. That's the challenge as a writer of this sort of drama. You constantly have to remind yourself that you know things that your characters don't. And if you can get that into the drama, I think it becomes very exciting and can feel quite fresh and sometimes a little bit dangerous, which I think good drama should be.
Yeah, that's terrifically well put, Heidi, because I always say to people, they didn't know they were living in the past. Oh, now, we're living in the past, brilliant. And we don't know. If you don't reflect what's going on in the world, it's as if you're living in a cocoon in a studio. Mm. But all Heidi's choices would have been discussed by upstairs people and downstairs people, and everybody would have been affected. So I think Heidi's right. You absolutely have to have that. Or it is soap opera.
Actress Jean Marsh plays Rose in the original and new version of Upstairs, Downstairs. Heidi Thomas is the head writer from the new series. It premieres on Sunday on PBS's Masterpiece Classic. And if that leaves you wanting more, an Upstairs Downstairs 40th Anniversary DVD boxed set has just been released. I'm Linda Wertheimer, NPR News.
American composer Eric Whitaker is a superstar in choral circles. His music is performed by amateur and professional choirs alike. His chiseled good looks have earned him a modeling contract. And tomorrow night, he unveils his Virtual Choir 2.0 on YouTube. It features over 2,000 singers from around the world, including reporter Jeff London.
I've been singing in real choirs since I was a kid, so I was very intrigued to participate in a virtual one. I asked Eric Whitaker how he came up with the concept.
Well, it all started with this video. A young girl named Britlyn Losey, who was 17 at the time, posted to YouTube a video of herself singing the soprano part to a piece of mine called Sleep.
Hi, Mr. Eric Whitaker. My name is Britlyn Losey, and this is a video that I'd like to make for you. Ever since I heard your song Sleep, I have been addicted to your music. Music is my life, it is my heart, it is everything. And you've touched me.
I was just so moved by the way she was singing and the look on her face. She looked directly into the camera and she had such a pure, sweet tone. And it struck me. I thought, God, if I could get 50 people to do this all at the same time from around the world, post their videos, and then we could cut them together, we could make a virtual choir.
So Whitaker experimented. He rounded up some singers, had them sing individually into webcams while listening to a piece of his on headphones, and had a technician cut the videos together. The experiment was so successful, Virtual Choir 1.0 was born. ...185 singers from 12 different countries sang Whitaker's Lux Aurumque.
My biggest hope was that we'd be able to find some actual musical gestures, rubato with slowing and speeding up of the tempo, and dynamics where we could get people to sing very soft and more full in different places. And it really worked.
The video has had almost 2 million hits on YouTube. So when Virtual Choir 2.0 was announced, I went for it. I downloaded my music, printed it out, and got my instructions via a YouTube video.
And now a few instructions for recording your track. First, make sure that your face is well lit, nice and bright. Please make sure that your clothes are only black.
And after a beep, I started to sight-read the piece and sing along with a piano track while watching Eric Whittaker conduct.
The evening hangs beneath the moon.
It took me quite a while to get the hang of it, adjust to Whittaker's tempos, which were very loose, and respond to his gestures. And, of course, learn the notes. It was nothing like singing with a real choir, where you listen to the people around you, work on blending your voices together, and breathe with them. But I practiced and practiced with that little piano track, and a few days later, recorded myself on video, several times before I felt I got it right.
Upon my pillow, safe. In bed.
Eric Whittaker knows it's a kind of strange process.
There's this incredible leap of faith on the part of the singer, where you're just hoping, sort of beyond hope, that somehow this works, right? That you'll do your little bit for this, and then months later find out, oh, okay, that I helped make this happen.
And when I finally saw and heard the video, with 2,051 singers from 58 different countries, I was convinced. I called Britlin Losey, the young woman whose video started the whole shebang. What was it like to inadvertently inspire the virtual choir?
Amazing. I still can't even explain it.
Eric Whittaker's Virtual Choir 2.0, featuring his piece Sleep, makes its debut on YouTube tomorrow evening. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.